Sonja Johnson's feminist activism began in 1977 when she took a stand supporting the Equal Rights Amendment at a Mormon church meeting. She extended her support and enthusiasm for the ERA to Washington, D.C., and beyond to other cities of the nation. And by the end of 1979, she had so effectively aggravated the Mormon hierarchy that this lifelong Mormon was excommunicated. She has, in the past 10 years, continued into a feminist philosophy and has come to believe that women, by re-choosing liberation and by re-choosing feminism, can transform the world. Maybe, in her words, actually doing that as we speak. Johnson believes a patriarchal system lies at the core of the world's problems, especially, but not exclusively, affecting women, and that the system cannot be changed from within, that political change arises from personal change, and that women's values lie at the core of a new and revolutionary thinking emerging worldwide. Good afternoon. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is KUAC-FM, Sunday at Noon. Welcome, Sonja Johnson. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Susan. It's great to be here.
I would like, if I can, to go back for those people who do not know who Sonja Johnson is, or if they do, perhaps have a headline memory of you of some years ago, so we can get a picture both of you and how your thinking has emerged. So if I set up a moment in time, can you respond to that?
Sure,
glad to. Okay. My sense is that you were born into a dual and very patriarchal set of societies. One has its face and body in the Mormon Church, which holds that maleness is closest to godness, if I have it right. And the other is by virtue of the time in which you came into life in this country. As you came into adulthood in the late 50s, it was a time when women were very much measured internally as well as externally against men. The relationship of a full woman was found in that she had a husband and that she had children, rather than anything else that she might do. So I want to check that against you to see if that's accurate and see if you can fill in a picture for me of your early life.
I think you've said it beautifully, actually, that I was born to Mormon parents whose ancestors had been Mormons. We had been Mormons by the time I came. I was the fifth generation. And that goes back about as far as the church goes. I was also born in the Mormon West, which is all, Mormons born in other places have other experiences. So I was born in community and lived in communities in my youth until I was married, where almost everybody was Mormon. I mean, you scarcely knew anybody who wasn't. And you hardly knew, I mean, it wasn't really real to you that there were people who were other things. That's how monolithic the society was. I was also born at a time that was true all over the country, and in all small towns. I have since understood women who were born at my time, regardless of what religion they were born into, were born in little towns in the United States, where the attitude was that appearances count most. I mean, what people think about you is the most important thing. I must have heard 1,000 times or more in my life, what will the neighbors think if you do that? What will the neighbors say about us if they see that our daughter is whatever? The neighbors were always the threat, what they might think, what people would think. It seemed to be, and you know, I used to think that this was just the Mormons and my hometown.
Not at all.
But it was really American culture at that time, the late 40s during all the 50s. And so I actually in my teenage years felt great rebellion against the neighbors. I mean, they probably were perfectly fine people and were telling their kids, what will the neighbors think? And we were the ogres, you know.
Same,
same thing. But I must say that it's great now. It's wonderful now to be at a place in my life where it really doesn't matter to me what the neighbors think. It was hard getting rid of that measure, the measure from outside, that it doesn't really matter what kind of a person you're being. It matters what kind of a person you seem to be being. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if your family is really happy, as long as you put on a good face at church and in the community, as long as people think so, really, that's all that counts. That was very hard for an adolescent. You know, adolescents are peculiarly aware of cant and hypocrisy. And I was no different. When I, as I reached adolescence, I looked around at all this and was appalled at it. Was just appalled. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one. It was really evident to me. So when my kids got to be adolescents and they began to see all hypocrisy, I remembered vividly how that was the time when I really could see it. Mm-hmm. So it was a time also, just as you said, when women really didn't count at all, only insofar as they were associated with some man. And the more status the man had that you're associated with, the more status you had. In other words, everything was derivative and always through men. There was, on your own, you were, well, totally unacceptable and inadequate. It was not possible to really do. This was the mindset of the 50s. Not possible to do life on your own. I mean, you couldn't have managed it, mm-hmm. because you were nobody. And so the hunt was on. You know, all the young women looking for the men with the most status. In my culture, that was the guys that had gone on missions. First of all, who came from good families, came from families that had. Good reputations in the church, and then who'd been on missions, spent a couple of years going out into the world and preaching the gospel from door to door. That was a very high status thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then you just kept going. That spoke good English, because my parents were both teachers. It was very important that people speak correctly, and that had gracious manners, and that was educated or was planning to go on to college. And what you did then, your job was to put him through college. I understand that hasn't changed a lot, but you know, that was what we did. So that the feeling was certainly for me, and I always generalize from a sample of one. It can't just have been me. My feeling was that I was really nobody until I found some man who was somebody to accept me. And then by his acceptance, I became somebody, but only as long as he accepted me. It was an incredibly oppressive way to view the world. I look back and can't imagine how I believed all that. But, you know, I really did. I really was a woman of my time. When I say I was rebellious, I mean just as an adolescent, as adolescents were, but I didn't really ever see through the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I always believed the Mormon church was the only true church in the world. I always...
Your faith was very strong.
Oh, yeah. Well, I just bought it all. So when I became a feminist, I was my own greatest hope for the world, because I thought to myself, Sonia, if you can come from where you came and be here, anything is possible for anybody. And then when I became a lesbian, I thought, good grief, we can change more than I thought. I mean, the world can really survive, because look how much one person can change. So,
you've made several transformations, it seems to me. Some I know about and some I do not. But, for example, let me stop and let people know who are thinking here of who this woman is. Once again, Sonia Johnson. Is a feminist, considered it by some a leader in feminist thought. You're listening to Sunday at Noon, and I'm your host, Susan McGinnis. Sonia Johnson has authored three books. One is From Housewife to Heretic. The publishing company for that in 1981 was Anchor Books Doubleday. Going Out of Our Minds, The Metaphysics of Liberation, the Crossing Press Feminist series, published that in 1987, and Wildfire, Igniting the She-Volution, SHE/VOLUTION, published by Wildfire Books, her own company, in 1989. Again, this is Sonia Johnson. It seems to me that you have made several transformations. When reading From Housewife to Heretic, I noticed a movement in that book from strong and spiritual faith in the Mormon religion through to the essence of what Jesus called Christ was teaching, but separated from your disappointment in the Mormon faith. And then you moved from there. Can you take a look at spiritual transformations
in your mind? Sure, and I just want to make sure that I acknowledge that this is what's happening to people. I hardly meet, especially to women. I can't say a lot about men. I mostly know what's happening to women. And almost every woman I meet and talk to nowadays would not have recognized herself 3 years ago. I mean, if she could have looked ahead 3 years and seen herself now, she wouldn't have believed it. I mean, we are changing so fast, and not just superficially or cosmetically. I mean, deep, deep changes are happening in people at lickety-split speed. I mean, nothing like this, I'm sure, has ever happened before. This is really the frontier of change, where it was technological revolution just before us. Now we're into the spiritual revolution, which means we're going to be moving as fast spiritually as technology moved, or maybe faster. So it certainly did happen to me. I feel as if I've had several lives in one lifetime without having to die and be reincarnated. You know, I think that's splendid. I look at my mother. She had one life. Her life was of a piece from the beginning until almost the end. That doesn't mean that she didn't change in her thought, but very, very slightly. Not because she wasn't as smart as I was, not because she wasn't a magnificent woman, but because she wasn't in this time. This is the time for it. We're in it now. What happened to me, I began to become not the typical Mormon when I married. I married a fellow who had come from back east, we called it. He came from Milwaukee, which is really the Middle West, but you know, if you're out in Logan, Utah, it looks like back east. And he hadn't been raised a Mormon. In fact, he didn't join the Mormon church until he knew he had to marry me. And
it's a Baptist, well, you know.
He was a Baptist. And that was one of the smartest things I ever did, was marrying Rick. Really a very brilliant move on my part, because he was an unusual man for his time. And maybe it was because he hadn't been raised in a Mormon church, I don't know. I think he was probably unusual for the Baptist or whatever he was. He encouraged me to get my advanced degrees. He wouldn't hear of me putting him through school. I mean, he just kept shattering all my preconceived notions of how things had to be. Well, why should you do that? He said, you're as smart as I am. Let's both do it. You know, you can get a fellowship, and I'll get a fellowship, and we'll do it together. I mean, this is 1959. Mm-hmm. You know, this is an unusual person.
With a baby on the roll.
Well, certainly, well, not at that moment, but certainly, certainly unusual man for Logan, Utah. Mm-hmm. I'd never met any man like this. And then as soon as we married, we got out of the Intermountain West. We began our series of journeyings to other countries. Because we both were very curious about how other people lived. And so we decided, without even really deciding, our lives began to take the turn that we would come home from being abroad for a couple of years. We'd spend a year or so in this country, and then we'd start looking around for some job we could get in some country. And then we'd take off for that place. And I'd usually teach at university, and Rick would do some research job somewhere. So we lived in five or six countries during our lives for a couple of years each. And while I was in those countries, the Mormon church wasn't around. There was no church, so I didn't go to church. So in a way, without even noticing, although I still was deeply committed to the Mormon church and really believed it, I wasn't under it all the time. I mean, wasn't hearing it. I wasn't associating with Mormons. I was, in a sense, really being liberated from those shackles without noticing it. The first place that we moved back to this country for good was Virginia in 1977. And that's the first I'd heard of the ERA. Mm. Almost instantly, and that meeting where I went in the Mormon church to hear about the ERA, I became a feminist on the spot. I mean, I'd known there was something called the women's movement going on in the world and in this country in particular. And I hadn't felt any, you know, animosity toward it or any negativity toward it. It was just quite, I thought that I didn't need it. I mean, I was having a marvelous life. I had a good marriage with person that was interesting and fun and valued me, and I was doing the work I liked to do. I was teaching poetry and writing. Oh, gee, you know, just the perfect thing, and had all these wonderful women helping me. I mean, maids and cooks and all those things, and wonderful kids. And so whatever it was that women were agitating for, well, I didn't mind that they were, but I didn't need it, whatever it was. So I clearly didn't understand the women's movement at all. Mm-hmm. But that night in the Mormon church, all in a flash. I mean, in an epiphany, really. I knew what the women's movement was all about. And it wasn't really anything any of those men said as they talked against the ERA. I mean, they said the usual nonsense, all of it uninformed and really, really foolish. It wasn't so much that. It was that I was ready. It was my time. And it wouldn't have mattered almost what anybody had said. I would have suddenly just known. And I just knew all at once, sitting in that room with about 40 other people, I knew where women had been in this society, despite all the curtains pulled across our eyes, all the scrims trying to keep us from really seeing where we really are, all the propaganda. I knew the truth of our position in this society and how it had been for in societies for back as far as we could see, and I thought that I might die on the spot of the pain of that realization.
You used a very interesting illustration in your book, From Housewife to Heretic, to describe that time, and it was the bursting of the files.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe that briefly? It connected with me when I was reading it. I stopped and said, oh my, I know just what that is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that this is how a lot of us become feminists, especially when we have this burst of light on the subject. It's ever since I was born, female and Mormon, there had been, obviously, I had had experiences that right from the beginning, coming out of the womb, when somebody said, oh, it's just a girl, probably. That's probably what something like they said. From that, I put that information in this little file box in my head that was information about myself as a person. And all through my life, I just put these little pieces in that file. The little discordant notes, these little unpleasant things that I didn't want to really look at or couldn't understand or didn't have any framework to fit them on. But there they all were, saved and tucked away, because, you know, we never forget anything. We were told that everything we ever heard, ever knew, we have just tucked it away, stored it in our memory, you know, in our
somewhere
computer
in
memory.
Manner.
Sure,
yeah.
Somewhere we've got it all. Well, I did the file image before I knew about computers. Now I would say I just saved it on the, you know, and it just went into the hard disk, and it was just always there. And but you see, Mormon women, I mean, all women have big files. I mean, many, many instances of incredible woman hatred coming at us and massive discrimination and being humiliated and being in all kinds of ways, being spiritually and physically and emotionally wounded and smallened and beaten down. You know, we all have many, many instances of this in our lives, almost continually, really. And so what we do is just put them in this big file folder called What It Means to Be a Woman, that we can't make much sense out of. We've got it all filed away. Well, all women have very big files by the time they grow up. They're all very full, but Mormon women's are, I mean, burst bulging, because we even get more of this. I mean, women in fundamentalist fundamentalist religions, period, get lots more of this than just the ordinary Methodists and Unitarians among us, the Presbyterians, you know. So my file was not just the usual women's file of the 50s, which, as I say, was immense. Mine was just about ready to pop. And then I went to this meeting, and these guys said a few idiotic things, and that's all I needed. I mean, one little, it was like the straw that broke the camel's back. One little piece of information fell into that file, and it just couldn't take any more, and it just exploded. I mean, all the information about being female that I had been storing up spilled into my conscious mind, in a way, or spilled into my awareness that I knew how I had been treated as a woman. Something that I had never been able to look at, never dared to touch, because what would I do with this? How could I live? I mean, there was no place to put it. There wasn't anything called feminism when I grew up. There was no place called the women's movement. And a few things that I did in my life along the way about on the subject of the double standard in sex and everything, the things I'd say in church, and everybody was outraged, and my family about fell apart. You know, I'd kind of learned really to keep these blinders on and not look at them, because they got me in serious trouble every time I noticed them. Well, all of a sudden, all of that just came, the file burst, and it was all available to me at once. And it was an amazing thing about this phenomenon. Every time it's happened to me, I've had smaller bursts since, you know, my books are full of my little bursts of these little files, it's perfectly organized when it comes. I mean, it makes you simply know. You aren't all confused. It's not like little bits of information floating. I mean, it's like it's all, you've got it. On some level, you have always been arranging this and getting it in order so that when it finally comes to you, you know absolutely what it's all about. Well, I just knew. And I think the most painful part of what I knew was how much men hated us. It was unbearable to know this. You know, the propaganda is that men really care about us and really love us, and the church leaders, particularly in the Mormon church, are always saying how much they love the women of the church and appreciate them and how marvelous they are. And, you know, this is what your conscious mind hears, but underneath it all, you know, you're taking in all the behavior, the words you're believing, but the behavior is also registering. And so I was shocked by my knowledge of the hatred that men have felt toward women. I mean, I think hatred is a small word. And I was, that's why I was in pain that night. I just thought it's impossible to know this and live. How can one really know, understand how they must have felt about us all these thousands of years and still go on with life? Because, you know, men are women's children, and we've loved them so.
You know, listeners all over Fairbanks and beyond may be stopping and saying, what is this woman saying? I predict there are a few howls going on at this moment and a few arms stretching out to snap off the radio. Yeah. Tell me what you mean about men hating women. Find a box for this so we can let people hold it out in the listening
audience. What I knew without really knowing the details or the statistics, I later did find out. Then, well, for instance, as I went forth from that meeting, I began to get the details. I mean, I had the gestalt, but I needed the details. So I began reading all the new feminist books. I mean, they were new then, you know. We were just beginning to talk.
1977.
Yep. And so what I began to learn were things such as every day in the United States, 2,000 men rape women. Now, that's an FBI figure. So, like all FBI figures, particularly about women, it is very low. I mean, it's not accurate at all. The women who work in the rape crisis business will tell you that that's a low figure. But let's just take it as, let's just presume that that's true. The 2,000 men today, this day you and I are speaking, half are going to rape women in the United States. I knew that there was rape. And I knew that it was a crime of violence, and that it was a crime of it wasn't a crime of passion. It wasn't because you like women. It's because you don't like them, and because you want to hurt them, because obviously that's what it does, and you wouldn't do it if it didn't. And I knew how rape would feel. I knew that it would be an act of incredible hatred to me for somebody to do that. So it was clear that this was happening massively. And it was also clear that women were being beaten by men. You know, like 50% of heterosexual relationships, women were being physically assaulted in them. I didn't know that then, but I learned that statistic later. But I knew women were being beaten. I knew that I'd been humiliated about being a woman all my life in the church. And I knew that always I had felt less than, always. I mean, in school, in everywhere, I had known that I was less. I had known, and I didn't feel worthy. I didn't feel as if I was as important That's a serious thing, you know. Just that alone is enough brutality to the soul. I also knew, not the way we've come to know in recent years, but I also knew that incest was endemic, and that this is a way also to take away women's feelings of worth and feelings of wholeness, that it shatters in some way the psyche, and we don't know who we are or what we're about, that we are being, in a sense, emotionally disabled, that the effort was deliberately to do this to us. As I became more and more a feminist, or became, as I went on in my years of writing and speaking, it became very clear to me that all the things I've mentioned, and more poverty, I mean, we are the people in the world who are poor. Women are the poverty people of the world. You know, the UN statistic that says that women do 2/3 of the world's work and make 1/10 of the world's money and own 1/100 of the world's property. I mean, that's slavery. That's slavery, to do 2/3 of the world's work and make 1/10 of the money. It means that you do all the work and you get almost nothing for it. I mean, we're talking about an economy based on slave labor globally. That's what it says. And so I realized that women are the poor, and that and I remember a statistic I read in 1985 or something that said that by the year 2000, the entire poverty population of the United States is going to be women and our children. I mean, so close to 99.9999%. It's us. I mean, we're the ones who are deprived. We're the ones that don't have enough. We're the ones that are living under terror of not being able to have anything to eat tomorrow. As I went on in my feminist career, I began to realize that rape and battering and incest and poverty and humiliation and all the discriminatory things that won't let us do what we need to do or keep us out of certain programs and so on, all these things were institutions of patriarchy, that they were institutions like the law. They were institutions like the church and the schools, that rape is absolutely essential to keep men controlling the world and women and controlling us as natural resources on this planet.
It's a tremendous accusation. Well, I mean, you're not saying that these things are accidents of the general miasma of humanity.
No, I'm saying this is deliberate and necessary. And one of the ways you can know this is that the men who rape, look how long we have tried as women, just in this second half of the women's movement, to try to get men prosecuted for rape. I mean, it's a losing battle. We just get something passed, and something looks like it's going to happen, and then it gets, you know, not enforced, not interpreted. I mean, we cannot seem to get it taken seriously or to get it stopped. But what you know is that it's therefore a necessary thing. It has to happen. And you know this from other ways, too. I mean, it's important for women to know that it's important for us to be terrorized at all times. Rape is a terrorist tactic. It's a way to keep people off balance. It's a way to keep them from feeling solid and secure, to keep them feeling powerless and like prey all the time. It's essential in order to keep women down. I mean, women are marvelous, magnificent creatures. I mean, we are splendid and brilliant and strong and courageous. How have we been kept on our faces in the mud for 5,000 years? How did this happen? It takes violence so immense that it is unspeakable. It demands it. You can't keep anybody oppressed without violence so enormous that it is, as I say, practically unthinkable, because human beings are not meant to be governed by other people, not meant to be owned, not meant to be enslaved. We're not meant to be slaves. We were born to be free, self-governing people. So to take that kind of an organism and for 5,000 years keep it not being in any way reaching what it could reach has required institutions, has required certain behavior from certain numbers of men now for literally millennia. And one of them is rape. Rape must happen. Today it must happen. Or we could stop feeling afraid. We could start feeling powerful. We could start thinking, hey, you know, I could do things. Hey, you know, I could build a new world. We've got to be We have to be terrorized about men's power over us, men's control. And battering does the same thing. And incest does the same thing. And poverty does the same thing. And being kept out of the important decision-making places does the same thing. All of this is institutional. I mean, it's systemic. It isn't accidental and just happened here and there. It happens globally in every race, every class, every nation of the world. This happens to women. It is absolutely part of the system. Just like, as I say, as the governments and the legislatures and the heads of state and the school systems in every place, also rape, incest, battering, murder, humiliation, discrimination on all levels, poverty, absolutely every place. This is part of patriarchy. That's, in a sense, what I knew that night in a broad way. I didn't know the details, but I knew. Why have men done this to us, I asked myself. I mean, I sat in that room that night, Susan, and moaned aloud. I mean, Mormons don't say things in their meetings. I mean, they don't say, yay, men, and right on, brother. You know, we sit there it's like a boring business meeting. Well, here I was saying, oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no, please. Oh, no. I mean, I just thought, I can't. I was saying it aloud. Well, Mormons were almost wetting their pants. I mean, it was very frightening to them to see somebody. I mean, my whole life was breaking up, Susan. Mm-hmm. I mean, the foundations on which I'd built my life were disappearing under my feet. And I was standing in thin air. That's how it felt. And that's how it feels to women when they look at it. I can understand why women don't want to be feminists. I can understand why when the ground begins to open up and we begin to see what has been done to us by the very people who are our children that we have loved, just loved. I can see why we'd say, oh, no, I don't want to look at that. It's not true. And why we will just live in denial. I can understand that, and I don't blame one woman that refuses to see it. Women who say, I don't need to be a feminist, and I think that's all nonsense, I say to them, I just think it's fine for you to believe what you have to believe. Some women really, I think, would die if they knew. I thought I was going to die sitting there. I thought, you know, I had I later learned was an existential crisis. I really didn't think I'd live to get out of that room. I thought, this cannot be borne. It cannot be borne. We can't live with this.
You're listening to Sonia Johnson in town this past week, as you will be listening to this, to talk about these very things. Sonia Johnson is a feminist, needless to say. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Sunday at Noon. Talking about transformations.
Yep.
Although I'm not sure that was a transformation as much as it was a...
It was, so it really was.
Railroad car racing through you.
Yeah, well, yeah, but it changed everything. Mm-hmm. And people think, well, what it did is cause you to hate men, but in fact, no, that's not what it did. What it did was to cause me to devote my life to seeing to it that this ceased to be the case. It became impossible to accept that life had to go on this way. It must change, I said to myself. And so, like all the rest of the feminist activists in the world, I set forth in any way I could see to do whatever I could see that I thought might change this, might help there to be love in the world, might cause it to be the way I had believed Christianity had said it should be, that we would all treat each other as we wish to be treated, that we'd just love one another. I wanted that to be possible. I didn't want to hate anybody. And I'm not good at hating. And I don't think women do hate. And when I hear people say, oh, well, you just hate men, I think they forget that women are not good haters because every body is our children. I mean, we are the ones out of whose bodies these people came. Hate is not possible for people who are you. Partly you. You know, women are not good at hating. And I don't think I ever felt any. I was angry. Oh, I was angry, angry. But you know, there's a very great difference between anger and hatred. I don't know that I've ever felt hatred for anything in my life. I don't even know what it feels like. I just know I felt such anger. And you know, it really did fuel the first part of the women's movement in this, in the 60s and the 70s. I mean, the anger, the incredible rage at what had been done to us. And what had we ever done to deserve? I mean, why? I mean, the total unfairness of it all. For a long time, you know, I went along using that as fuel. But there came a place when I just wasn't angry anymore.
What's your sense of the other side of the equation? I mean, you've pretty clearly illustrated what happens to women through the instrument of what you call the patriarchy. What happens to the men? Have you looked at that?
I've looked at it some. It's harder to look at for me because I'm not one, you know. I've tried to be very careful in my feminist life not to do to men what I haven't liked that they've done to me, which is interpret me and tell me who I am and why I do the things I do and what I'm all about and how I'd be best fulfilled and what my role in the world is and all those things when they have never been a woman for one single second of their lives. I mean, the incredible arrogance of that. I have just tried not to do the same to them. But I've had three sons, you know, and I love them as much as if they were daughters, and I have wondered because of them. I also have a daughter. I have four children. And I've wondered because of my sons and watched them to see what it has done in their lives. And what I know is that to be an oppressor is profoundly, characterologically damaging. That whether you choose it or not, and of course little boys don't choose it, they came out of the womb little boys and they didn't have anything to do with that as far as I know. But they immediately, the minute they come out of the birth canal and they have penises, they begin to have privilege at women's expense. And anybody that has privilege at anybody else's expense is corrupted by that, characterologically damaged by this. Because I look at my sons, how can it be that they couldn't, on some level in their spirits, be hurt by, I mean, be less than or be smallened by the fact that they are listened to more, their lives are saturated with privilege they don't even see. I mean, men will say to me, I don't have any. I mean, why men will say to me, oh, I don't have any privilege, I got to go to work. I mean, they have no idea of the privilege that they're walking around in. I mean, women can't, we are speechless when they say, I don't have any privilege. I mean, it's unbelievable that they can't see it, but they can't. I mean, we can see it looking from the outside in, you know, our hands up against the window looking in at that big feast, you know, we can see it, but in the feast it just seems perfectly normal, and they don't see it at all. But I'd say to myself, these sons of mine, people take them more seriously at age 13 or 12 than they take me at age 45. If I'm in place with my sons, and they were all tall and handsome, you know, people would ask them, as if I were not there, questions that they should be asking me. Talk to them. They would listen to them. They wouldn't listen to me. You know, it wouldn't take me seriously. This is a great privilege to be. Assume that what you're going to say is important. Assume that you have something to say and that you're smart and that it would be beneficial to listen to you. This is a privilege beyond description. And my sons had it from birth. And they had it because today, every day of their lives, men, their cohort, so to speak, on this planet, raped 2,000 women, beat half of the women that they were associating with to the point of killing them sometimes or gravely leaving, you know, great masses of them damaged and for life with no kidneys and so on. I mean, my sons had that privilege because of the most hideous and most heinous crimes against humanity that I could imagine. You know, it can't be that it didn't have some effect on them. It can't be that privilege doesn't corrupt. And then you look at what the men who control the world do in the world and you see clearly the corruption. I mean, you see that everything on this planet is dying. It means it kills off something in people. There has to be massive denial, massive numbing out in order to bear this for any of us, because we're all human, even for men too. My sons have gotten not to be able to face this, because what if they did? How would they live knowing this? I mean, so they do know it, but then they just spend most of the time in denial, as we all do. If we really knew I mean, if we really all the time tried to keep conscious of what was going on between men and women, we would, I think, most of us would just die of it right on the spot. So we don't be conscious of it all the time. We suppress it. And men particularly have to numb out a lot. And then what do they do when their emotions are all numb and when they don't care and when they don't love and when they can't feel joy? Then they begin to project that kind of stuff out onto the world, and they make a world in which joy is not possible, where people are starving, where all species are dying away, where we're cutting down the Amazon forests just to have a hamburger. You know, it's out of people who are somehow so damaged that comes a world that looks like this world. And men have made this world. This is the way men have made a world. This is men's world. How we know how men are inside is to see the way they were, how it materialized outside them. I think that's one of the saddest things I know, that men are this way. I mean, I think patriarchy is desperately disfiguring for all of us. Desperately, but in very different ways. So I don't say men are oppressed, mm-hmm. because then it makes your oppression and my oppression invisible. So I say, this is what happens to women. This is what happens to men. We don't have the same experience on this planet at all. It's as different as if we had fallen off Mars or something. You know, so to try to talk about all of us being oppressed blurs what is really happening. So, and that's about all I know to say about men, is that I just notice the world they make, and there's a great sadness inside me that they feel that way inside themselves.
You worked very hard to change the system, so to speak.
I did.
And worked, especially on the Equal Rights Amendment, for a good many years through its extension. And you have, it seems, at first blush, to have given up the fight through any sort of legislative or legal system. I'm interested in that.
Well, I've given up the fight, period, because I discovered along the way, for myself, a very important principle. And, you know, of course, I think it's probably a principle for everybody, but I don't try to foist it upon folks. I just tell them why I think so. I came to the place after all that, looking around myself, where I began to understand that what we resist persists, that we entrench what we fight against, that because the means are the ends, because how we do something is what we get, that there are no means to ends because there is no linear time. Because the means are the ends, then fighting just creates more fighting, creates more fighting, creates more fighting. And I knew from being a mother that the surest way to get my kids not to do what I wanted them to do was to make a federal case out of what they were doing, because I just entrenched them in it. Well, I looked at the world for the last 5,000 years, and what I knew was that for 5,000 years women have been trying to get the men not to do the world this way, not to kill off everything, not to kill people, not to kill off joy and hope, and not to do it. Women have been fighting patriarchy for 5,000 years in every way we knew how to do it, in every way we could, all down through known history. We have been fighting it. And what I think two things about that. First of all, it obviously didn't work. And second of all, I think 5,000 years is long enough to try something that clearly doesn't work. And the reasons I think it doesn't work, one of them is that I think what we fight, we entrench, that we have, in effect, been collaborators in making patriarchy as long-lasting. I mean, it is a very weak system, really. It's not based in power, it's based in powerlessness and hopelessness and despair. That's a weak kind of stuff. We have helped it go along as long as it can by taking it seriously, by believing it's very important, by believing it's very strong, and then participating with it as if it were that way, and fighting against it and entrenching men in their positions until now we have got... And it's kind of like thinking of patriarchy as a big fortress and are trying to... bash it down with a big battering ram. Well, every time we hit a little place in the wall, it's a little weak and goes, you know, then the men say, boy, get over there. And they get over there and they shore it up. So now we are partly responsible for the strength with which patriarchy has been able to continue on this planet because of that. Also, I realized one day that we were asking the wrong people to change the world. I mean, this apparently is the way men do worlds. And for the most part, you know, on the whole, most men don't think this is too bad a job. It's women who look at this and think, this is intolerable. It's just intolerable. Well, obviously, then, the people who don't like it are the ones that must do something about it to try to get the men in the legislatures to do the things, as change it as deeply as we want them to. It's absurd. I mean, I couldn't even make the kids, the people that came right out of my own womb, who have my own DNA strings just flooding all through their bodies, whom I know intimately, who I love and whom I respect and who love and respect me, I can't even make them do what I want them to do. What made me think I could make these guys, whom I don't even know in the legislature, do what I want them to do? We can't really change anybody but us. I learned that as a mama.
You dropped two very interesting concepts into your string of thought.
What's that?
One is the means are the ends, and the other is, and of course we know there's no such thing as linear time.
Right.
Can you take those one at a time and show us how they fit
how
into
they fit?
Your fabric?
Well, sure. Nuclear physicists have been telling us for some time, and it's just been recently that it's been making sense to me in the last few years. I mean, I've been able to internalize that that's really true and see what it means for making change on this planet. You see, all I really want, Susan, is another world. I want a world where we all love each other. There's peace and there's happiness. There's plenty. There's fun. That's really all I want. So for 10 years now, that's all I've been trying to figure out. How? And so one day it occurred to me, as I've been thinking these things over, that the fact that there's no linear time is the reason. And, you know, no linear time, the nuclear physicists tell us we live in an atomic universe. And that in atomic structures, there linear time is not a fact. I mean, there is no linear time. All time just is. Well, we are in an atomic universe. It means in this universe, linear time is a construct. It has been invented on purpose for some reason, and I have a lot of theory about that. But in fact, what we know is there really is no linear time. There really is. There is none. How time is, apparently, the best way I know to explain it is that all time is present at once. That all the time that there ever was or ever will be, you and I are sitting in this minute. This is all time. That it is around us like it's our medium. We live in time like fish live in the ocean. Time is our medium. We live in it. There isn't a little blob of ocean out there when the fish swimming around. There's a little blob out there saying, oh, if we're just really good fish and get our vitas together, one day we'll be in future ocean and it will be better in future ocean than it is in present ocean. And they don't think there's a little blip of ocean back there called past ocean. You know, they know. I mean, all the ocean is just all at once. The ocean is just at once, and so is time. There isn't such a thing as future. There isn't such a thing as the past. All time lives right here.
And how does that impact your thinking?
And how that impacts my thinking is this, that if all time is now, and this is all the time we have, what that means is that, I mean, that explains why the means are the ends. Why how we're doing it right now is what we're going to get, because there isn't any future. The present and the future and the past are all the same time. So we can predict the future by how we're acting in the present. You see, men's thinking goes like this. We want peace, right? They say this. I mean, I've never seen any evidence, but they say we want peace. Now, to get peace, we're going to have to, here are the means. Here's the end. Way over here, we've got goals. This goal-oriented thinking, this five-year plan thinking, this cause and effect thinking along a linear line goes like this. Here's peace out here. We want it. How are we going to get it? We're going to start way over here on the other end. We're going to bomb and bomb and bomb and massacre and eviscerate and lay waste and rape and pillage. And then there's going to come this little magical moment when some kind of alchemy is going to take place, I guess, and voila, peace is going to appear. And all my life, with that kind of thinking, I said, hey, just a minute, run that by me again. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't see how you got from rape and pillage to peace. Well, because, you see, and I felt stupid all my life. All my life I've noticed this thinking and noticed that I didn't get it and thought I was just dumb and men were just brilliant. And then one day in a feminist meeting, I realized that I didn't get it because it wasn't gettable. because there is no linear time, because how we do it is what we get. Women know this better than men. I don't know why, but we do. We have always been the peace people on this planet. We have been at the head of every peace movement for 5,000 years. And the reason is that women have always known there's only one way to have peace, and that's to be peaceful right now. This is how you have peace. You be peaceful right now. You can't get to peace from war. All you can get from war is more war, because the means are the ends. The way we do it is what we get, because there isn't any linear time. Because all time is right now. The past and the present and the future are all now. Have you noticed that there has never been a moment in your life that hasn't been now? Mm-hmm. I mean, all the moments are now. I mean, in the face of the most overwhelming evidence that there is no linear time, we all believe in linear time. And that is what I call brainwashing. How I know brainwashing is that in the face of the evidence, I believe something absurd. It is always now, which means that all time is now.
So, if, as you say, we are under the heel of a patriarchal culture,
right?
Then what we do, if the means are the ends, is to step out from that culture?
What we do is to act now the way we want the world to be in the future. Because the means are the ends. How we are being now, it will be the future. For instance, if I want a world in which women don't have to get down on their knees and beg men. In other words, I want a world in which women are not slaves, don't have to lick boots and plead with men to please make the world just a little better so I can survive in it. Then right now, I've got to get up off my knees. There isn't any getting to standing straight and tall in my full power by begging, 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 begging. And one day, there comes this little moment of alchemy when some kind of magic takes place, and voila, I am just standing here, not a slave anymore. I mean, if I act like a slave now, that's what I'm going to be in the future, because that's all the time I've got just now. So if I don't want to be a slave right now, I stop. Because there isn't any linear time. I was so excited when I discovered this. I just almost flew around the room because I wanted changes, and I knew I wasn't getting her. I knew women hadn't got anywhere with men for 5,000 years except made it worse. I knew we had made it worse. And it was unbearable that we'd made it worse. I mean, we'd given our lives to make it worse. You just can't bear it. So how not to do it anymore? How not to collaborate anymore? Well, how not to collaborate was simply not to act in any way that I didn't want women to have to act in the future. If I don't want women what else can I give an example of if I don't want? I used to have several examples of that, and I can't think of any more. But however I want women to be in the future right now, that's the way I can be. That makes the future this way. And if you can act this way right now, and if this other woman can act this way, if I don't want women to have to sacrifice what we need right now for other people, then right now I have to stop sacrificing. I have now to have what I need. I have to make sure that I always have what I need. And that I don't think of other people first, that I take responsibility for my own life first, that I consider myself my first and most important charge. My life is really, I am the only one who is taking care of it, and I have a responsibility to myself first of all human beings.
And you don't see this as a selfish so-called response, but as a responsible response.
This is a responsible response. Because, you know, when we take responsibility for other people, well, you know what's happening. Now we're learning about all this codependent stuff and learning about how we infantilize and make others incompetent by taking responsibility for them. How everything gets a mess. So if everybody would simply be in their own power, meaning take themselves seriously, love themselves, believe in themselves, forgive themselves easily. Then we'd be able to love other people, forgive them easily, be tolerant of them. It all starts here. We would be right about ourselves. We'd be right about everybody, wouldn't we? Mm. That's my belief.
We've got minutes left, probably 5 or 6.
So anyway, this is the reason I no longer do the things that I don't want women to have to do. I don't want women to have to ask men, can I do something with my body? I mean, that's slavery. So right now, I'm not going to do this anymore.
I want to ask you the pivotal question, though.
Yeah, what is it?
If indeed, for 5,000 years, women have been under, I used the word before, boot heel, and suffering the slings and arrows of a patriarchal culture, how do we wake up at whatever it is before the hour of whatever it is and say, oh, healed. I can function now. I mean, clearly, if we have people who have been raped and brutalized and right. against whom incest has been committed and against whom battering has been committed and inequitable marriages and inequitable
everything's
business relationships
no, you
and
name it
on
yet.
Through time, then, I mean, there are there are women and men grievously furrowed trying to get themselves out of old damaging lives.
Right.
How can we do this in an instant that Sonia Johnson says?
Well, you know, if there is no linear time, I mean, I know that we're stuck in the old world a lot, in the old mindset, the old paradigm. And what I know is that in that paradigm, process makes sense because there's linear time in our thinking. So we see
gotcha.
Process as a natural thing. I think the time is coming and rapidly coming. I'll get back to the first thing you said in a minute, but it's rapidly coming when there will be instantaneous change because that's the way change really is. It really is that way. Because it can't be any other way, because there isn't any linear time, so it really can't have been linear. It is all the way we have been trained to look at it for many reasons we have. But what I've noticed in the last 15 years in this movement, and I'll tell you what I think the women's movement has been, I don't think it's had anything to do with getting women in power, our men, I mean women in positions of control, our men to pass our laws or anything. I haven't looked at that as the important thing at all. What's been happening that has been world-changing is that we have been, in fact, recovering from incest. Our incest, we have been allowing our incest memories to come in the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
To come up, we have been ready because there's been enough women's spirit on this planet to allow women the safety to do it. Now, there's enough of our value system predominating in the world that is a safe time to do it now. There's been healing going on all over the level, all the substance abuse, all the looking at our families, all of which are non-function because that's a definition of family in this system. Looking at all of the ways we were hurt and all the things we believed that were wrong about ourselves and everything, that has been, there has been a revolution, an internal revolution going on. This
planet and in some ways, then, you're looking to a common consciousness to raise the level of the common consciousness.
Oh, sure. Oh, it will, and it has. I don't think we need to make any more converts. I think that there are enough of us already to do whatever has to be done, and I think that the mind now is really upon the planet. You know, I read People magazine on the plane coming here. You know, they have a special April issue. All through that issue, they were, for everybody they chose, the nine most people to change, and all of the, almost every one of them had to do with conservation. And they didn't say this is a conservation issue. I don't even think they knew it.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, that has just happened. It is just now, it is now the global mind. And the walls fall down in Berlin. Why? Because half the human race is rising to freedom. Because women in every race, every class, every nation of the world are rising up to our freedom. And so now the freedom mind is upon the planet. Every country, all or every paper you pick up, another country is not going to obey the Soviet Union. Another country is doing this. Another group is saying, hey, forget it, no more. And the reason is,
sorry.
The reason is the women's movement. So there are enough of us, and it will change the collective unconscious or whatever it is. It has already, and it will more and more. So, you know, I think all we have to do is go ahead, each one of us, and together do what we're going to do, and everything will follow. We don't need to go out proselyting anymore,
mm-hmm.
I don't think.
Fascinating hour, Sonia Johnson. Let me tell people what's on paper by you so that they can go and find if they would like to. And thank you again for talking with us.
Oh, my great pleasure, Susan.
Sonia Johnson is the author of From Housewife to Heretic, a book published by Anchor Books, originally by Doubleday. Publishing date is 1981. Going Out of Our Minds, The Metaphysics of Liberation is her second title, published by The Crossing Press, its feminist series, in 1987. And most recently, Wildfire, Igniting the Shivolution, published by Wildfire Books in 1989. Our guest today on Sunday at Noon, Sonia Johnson. I'm Susan McInnes. It's been a pleasure to be with you today. If I am reading my internal calendar right in this time of timelessness, the opera is going to take us off the air next week, but we'll be back the week after. And if I'm wrong, then we'll see you next week. Have a good Sunday.